Welcome to Uncovering the Seniors, our podcast about the avant-garde music scene here in Copenhagen, Denmark. I'm Jan Kardereit, your host, and today our guest will be Mark Solborg. Mark is a guitarist that has been a big part of the Copenhagen scene for a long time. He has recorded music with Nikolai Munch-Hansen, Evan Parker, Peter Bruhn, Mats Eilertsen, Emanuele Maniscalco, Francesco Bigoni, Anas Banke, and has released more than 20 albums. He also is one of the founding members of ILK, the collective music label here in Copenhagen. And still on ILK, he released a new project just 2 weeks ago, which is called Tungemål. It means something like tongue or language in English. It consists of two books and with it three CDs worth of music. So, Mark will of course tell more about that in this episode. He will also speak a bit about how ILK was founded and how ILK works now and the freedom it gives to the musicians and stuff like that. So let's get right into the episode.
Yeah.
So hey Mark, welcome.
Hey Jan.
Yeah. Super nice that you're here.
Yes.
I'm of course here also with our constant co-host, Jan Arne Rolles.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a nice morning, huh?
Yes, it is.
But it's a bit cold. I feel the winter coming.
It's November in Denmark, guys.
It's
shocking. Let's not make the typical Danish weather jokes.
Yeah, as always, to get the mood going. Yeah. Yeah. But it's still green. It's kind of crazy. I feel it's crazy. I saw some pictures from home in Norway. There is some snow where my parents are.
Yeah.
Not so much green. So that's something.
Mark. We actually wanted to have this podcast episode with you already in spring, but then the whole Corona thing happened. And since then, new stuff happened. You brought out a completely new project. But before we get into that, the original thought we had when you wanted to comment on Spring, we wanted to speak a bit about ILK, the label.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can start with that.
Yeah, sure.
That's, I'm curious. You're one of the founding members of ILK, right?
Yeah, I was part of co-founding ILK along with a bunch of other guys.
And that was
in 2002, I believe. Yeah, there was a year where we sort of were kind of figuring out how to do this, and that's maybe the way to explain sort of my co-foundingness was that Stephen Pasbo and Jeppe Skovbakke and Jakob Anderskov and me sort of were in some ways given the job to sort of set up a frame for a group of people, a group of artists that was also really closely connected to two specific years on the Rhythmic Conservatory in Copenhagen. There's a connection there.
Together.
We were studying together, yes,
okay, yeah.
And had been studying together for quite a while. But and this whole group of people sort of needed an outlet for all the music that we had going on. And it was right in that period where a lot of new labels came up in Europe because, you know, the production costs were going down. Mm. So everybody, all of a sudden, you could actually afford to do this yourself. So it was do-it-yourself prime. And I do believe we can say that ILK was sort of a first mover on that thing in Denmark. I mean, you can... what we wanted to do was not to wait for the bigger labels to sort of... decide whether we were worthy to go out into the world, because we had a lot of music on our minds, and also I think we're part of a scene that we were kind of sort of, we felt that there was parts of the whole jazz scene, as in the widest term of the word jazz, that was sort of missing in Denmark. You know, the improv scene was really small, and a lot of us has been studying abroad, so we had been listening to a lot of music outside of Denmark and thinking, hey, why is this music not here? Why does nobody knows Derek Bailey? Nobody knows Evan Parker. Or the ones who knows Evan Parker, there's like 10 people in Denmark. That kind of everybody had some kind of idea that the music maybe was or the scene was wider than what you could actually experience in Copenhagen at that point. That's almost 20 years ago now. So in some ways, I think we have succeeded much with, or at least Ilk has evolved beyond our wildest expectations, because we actually managed to release more than 250 records with a huge number of international, you can say superstars within the idiom, but also representatives or exponents, you would say, of different styles and different attitudes toward the concept, towards the concept of improvisation, the concept of jazz, all these kinds of things.
Yeah, concept of creative music, or whatever you call it.
You could call it creative. That would be, that's a nice term that I like using myself, sort of creative music. But the whole thing, but again, what is creative? Who's not being creative?
Yeah.
It's kind of a little, everybody's
but,
a creative.
But I mean, you would also kind of like to use the word progressive music, but the progressive word has been hijacked, especially in the rock and metal scene. Become this thing that isn't very progressive.
Yeah, it's so difficult but maybe it's easier to
avant-garde is also being, I feel avant-garde also is the word that's starting to become hijacked. It means this very specific thing that was in the beginning of the 1900s. That's
But the avant-garde, that's the front line.
Yeah,
and you're kind of thinking,
but that's why it's hijacked, it feels,
exactly,
for me.
Exactly. You can't really say that Henry Grimes, he's not front line anymore.
No,
his way of playing has existed for more than 50 years. I don't define that as front line. I define it as beautiful music, but
exactly.
And maybe a genre or a certain attitude towards things. That's a thing, but getting back to the sort of the making of Ilk, so four people sat down and sort of tried to decide some very, very basic rules. I mean, you have people like Christian Osgo, Søren Kærgaard, Jakob Andersgo, me, Henrik Sund was part of it, as initial, Maria Lavrette Friis was part of it. So many people that have sort of very strong individual opinions and feelings about their music and feel very strongly about their individual artistic freedom. So it had to be a very open frame.
Yeah.
So basically, we sort of set up this framework. One really important thing is that once you're part of Ilk, you have total artistic freedom. That's sort of a main mantra. You know, the only thing that will sort of overrule that is if you do stuff that will threaten Ilk or the nation or the world peace or something like that. Then maybe we'll try and or do something pornographic. That might be actually also a little annoying. But I mean, that's kind of that. Those are kind of the limits. So you can do an improv album, you can do a pop album, you can do a rap album, you can do whatever you feel like as an artist, because the board or the artistic direction are the artists.
Yeah.
So eventually we sort of felt, okay, we had a lot of board meetings. Imagine, you know, all these people meeting once a month.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. And the more we got, and of course, the timing was super right. So we had a lot of on our hands and a lot of work that we wanted to do. And a lot of, we were also lucky to be offered a lot of concerts all over the world. So eventually we sort of started having less meetings and communicating more online and naming what we called executive committee, what's called forretningsudvalg in Danish, which means that a smaller group of people sort of have the mandate to take fast decisions on trivial daily matters like distributions or what is the price going to be in Belgium for this, blah blah blah, or they just called from Japan and want more of the Christian Osgo, Paul Bley album.
Sure.
Stuff like that. And then we also found out that, hey, we can do this, but there are people that are better at running the office than we are. So we actually, everybody sort of chips in, and then we have now have a label manager and has been having and has had a label manager for many years that part-time helps us out at the office. So there is an Ilk office that is manned, and that is a big advantage. I love it. I mean, sort of that somebody else can...
It means that you have more time for or everyone that's
but I think it's
more
it's
time
the,
for
it's,
other things, right? Or
it's the I really think it's the dilemma of the artists of our time that you can do it all yourself. You can do it all online. But should you? Because there's only 24 hours a day and you need to focus on the content because that's what we're good at doing, artists. And then it's really nice if somebody else do the production maybe. Mm. It has to be somebody you trust. It has to be somebody that you understands what you're doing. We also really, we spend a lot of time picking our label managers in ILK because it has to be somebody that understands that we are not here, not necessarily to make money. We will print a record that we know will sell 3 copies if we think this music needs to be in the world. So that's a whole other game compared to sort of the industry of music. So we need a label manager that understands that. But still, it's really nice to sort of hand out the tasks so that you get input from the outside, so somebody else sees what you're doing, so you don't become your own echo chamber when you produce music, when you produce art. And it's also really nice that some people that are not the that's not the artist is actually taking care of all of the framework that needs to take place for, say, a concert to happen or a record to come out.
Yeah, because you haven't only done records, you also done these events where it's ILK Nights here, or you also every year at the not this year obviously, but every year at the jazz festival you have an ILK stand and you or you play
like
at
5E this year, right?
If I should boast of something, that is that we're responsible for 6 to 8% of all of the concerts at Copenhagen Jazz Festival. The ILK stage at Copenhagen Jazz Festival. Which is quite something because there's 1,200 concerts at the at the Copenhagen Jazz Festival.
And it's
also, of course, for us, it's a way to sort of spread the music and the word and also do sort of a, it's also, you can say, not a PR event, or it's a way of making people aware of what we're doing. But again, what happened when we started all these live things is also that a lot of people from abroad, journalists and sort of musicologists and everybody who's interested that arrived at the Copenhagen Jazz Festival all of a sudden started coming to 5E because it was another kind of place. It was kind of, you can call it underground, or you could call it something that at least was described by them as authentic in some way, was happening there, which was, I mean, a good thing, a strong thing. I think I find ILK a very strong thing.
It must be a very defining label for the Copenhagen sound, I think, like since there's so many releases and so many people from the ILK.
Yes. I kind of
part that has been teachers at RMC, like I have and stuff like that. Cause, and since like improv is so glocal, I don't know, that's like a fancy musicology term I read somewhere, where you have
local
and
global.
Local and global.
Yeah, exactly. The art or the exercise of improvising is a global thing, and it speaks on a global scale, but each city has its way of improvising. Yeah. So it's like a local place. True. And imagine ILK must have had a lot to say, or the people individual in ILK or whatever you want to.
That's true, but I mean, there's several aspects to that. One thing I think is that you should definitely say really loud that the Copenhagen scene is not just ILK.
No, yeah, of course.
Other people, and there were definitely also some people doing a lot of work before before ILK arrived. I mean, people like Lotte Anker or Pierre Jørgen.
But she's part of ILK.
She became a part of ILK.
Yeah.
Peter Friis, people from that scene were kind of really did a lot of work with introducing the music to the audience and to the people.
Not suggesting that you came out of nowhere.
No. And then also, there's also a lot of the community and Barefoot, and there's all kinds of really nice initiatives and people working all over Copenhagen. And then again, Copenhagen still is a really small scene.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, working at a very high level, I really find that the Copenhagen scene can really keep up with almost any international scene in anywhere in the world, because the level of playing is so high. There's so many nice players in Copenhagen. I mean, that's really something.
I mean, for me, this is my outside perspective, right? But Ilgo always felt a little bit like the established label nowadays. Of course, it wasn't in the beginning, I assume. But coming here only a few years ago, on Ilgo are mostly the, from my perspective, established artists in that specific scene, whereas Barefoot Records feels a bit more younger and maybe a bit more underground, at least for now. Maybe, I mean, maybe in 20 years that will feel very different, right? But
maybe it's I mean, it's, I think you feel that because maybe you Ilk was started before Barefoot did. Maybe that's just this makes it feels like that.
Then
there was a kind of this sort of us also. Of course, we all grow older, and people get jobs as teachers, or they get an international career, or whatever. I mean, or both. And then also we have also changed some of the members of Ilk. People have felt that they needed to go somewhere else, and has sort of went in other directions. And we have also sort of invited new people to come. Kasper Tranberg is the latest member of Ilk, for instance. Peter Danstrup also came pretty late. So we when we are inviting people, and it happens very rarely because we are a lot now. We are more than 20 people that are part of Ilk, and we have a problem that right now we are releasing sort of almost 2 records a month, which is most other record companies find that totally insane.
Because it limits the promotion and everything.
It limits the promotion, and but we find that that's the way it should be. So there is, I find that there is a development, and I find that the sort of so call us the establishment is maybe a little too much, but I understand. But I understand why you're saying it. No, but it's also because you know,
kill the bureaucracy.
You know, for me it was like I felt like, you know, there was 1 year was like oh shit, no, I can't call myself one of the young musicians or young artists or young guitar players anymore.
Upcoming
the young upcoming band with Anders Banke and Mark Solborg. That was kind of at one point it became kind of no, now it doesn't sound right anymore, and that's that happens to everybody. It will happen to you.
I hope.
But on the other hand, I can sort of look back, and personally I can look back at more than 20 records. I'm releasing pretty much a record a year, something like that. And a lot of collaborations with really really nice artists that I'm very proud of, and that I also find I've learned so much of, like insanely amounts of sort of inside knowledge and about them, about the music, and about myself.
That's the perfect cue. Let's switch a bit of the conversation to speaking about your art, your music. You brought, for example, a new project here today, right? Like this is. It came out, what day is today? It came out like a week ago, on the 20th.
Yes.
And it's called Tungemål.
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 Yes.
I tried.
That's great. Yes.
I'm super curious. This is like a kind of not so common format, I guess, because it consists of 2 books and a lot of music.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, first of all, this project has existed in my life, in my workshop, på mit værksted, for a long time. For sort of the idea was, it's more than 3 years old, which is a long time for me, because I usually execute my ideas pretty fast, because I find that they grow old on me. Or I get bored with my own ideas if they stick too long, if they sit on my desk for too long. But this one I let sit for quite a long time. Because what I wanted to do was, I mean, the initial thought was to investigate my own language as a guitar player, or the language of the guitar in a specific context, which is like playing with other acoustic instruments. Because I found that I was always playing, or I am always playing with other acoustic instruments, and I'm the only one with a speaker. So that chamber, you can say chamber setting, with one electric guitar or one electric instrument in there is a strange thing. And, you know, we just consider that you're also a guitar player. You just consider sort of the amp and the guitar is sort of your, that's the instrument.
And, yeah, that, and maybe pedals.
And maybe electronics, but you can start looking.
Processed.
You start to look at the differences, saying, okay, so if I'm playing with Simon Tolderman and he plays a grand piano, I mean, he doesn't have effects. He doesn't have a speaker. If I'm playing with Francesco Pigoni or Lars Greve, they can sort of move their horn around. Or if I'm playing with a singer, they can kind of, they can. But if I want to move the source of my sound, I have to sort of swing the amp or something.
But if Simon is going to move the sound of the piano, exactly, he's going to need 8 people. So there is some similarity in that the speaker is an acoustic box. That,
yes,
but maybe it's maybe like the amplifier is more. It has the tube of a trumpet, but the immovability of a piano somehow, since it's like quite directional. And the piano is more omni, exactly, somehow.
Yeah. So I find that thing, because there is the some sort of translation takes place. My playing, the sound of my, or the resonance, the vibrance of the instrument will be translated into a pickup, converted into currency, and then out through the speaker again, and converted into waves in the air, sort of like. But that sort of introduces a whole new way of reacting to an instrument, compared to if I was playing a classic guitar or an acoustic guitar only. Yeah. But then I would die the minute Lars Greve, he takes out his baritone, because an acoustic guitar just say pling.
Yeah.
Right? And then...
But it's not only that. It's like, it's so thin. Yeah. It's not just the... Because I find that when I play with a piano player, I feel like no matter how loud I play, it feels just so thin.
Exactly.
It feels like, because you don't have this 4 strings or whatever per note or whatever.
That's one point. But the whole thing was, I found that there was some kind of the whole dynamic spectrum from, say, mezzo piano and down.
Yeah.
The very softest part of the guitar always gets lost. I found that with a lot of my students, and I found that with myself. Mm-hmm. So it was like, but if I really want to, you know, really want to whisper, can I do that on the guitar and still be in the room as an instrument like that? And that was kind of one approach, thinking about the lowest part of my dynamic register, or the softest part, that would be the right term. That's one aspect. And another aspect is, okay, if I am the one having the speakers and having the effects, why am I only playing through one speaker? Can I play through 2? Yes, I can play through. So I tried with 2. Can I play through 4? Yes, I can do that. So I tried through 4. Okay, so what are the qualities of my speakers? Because they are the instrument. So I have some really nice warm tube amps, you know, classic guitar stuff, you know, stuff that guitar players talk about, as horn players talk about reeds, or drummers talk about hits or whatever. But could I also play through really crappy speakers? Would that be fun? And I found that super fun, because then I can kind of sort of change the, that would be sort of comparable to when a singer all of a sudden sings through a bullhorn. I could do that, something similar with the guitar, if I used a small battery driven amp. And then all of a sudden I'm with a battery driven amp that I can carry. So now I can move around in the room. And all of a sudden, and all of this sort of is, you should sort of consider that this comes on top of some spatial experiments I have been doing with Axel Dörner and Christian Schütt. So I was already on the sort of track with saying, okay, can we actually be more inventive in the way we interact with each other in the room, with each other and with the audience? Because I found that, you know, the classic rock or jazz club, you know, there's a band on a stage, there's a speaker on each side, and then the audience sits in one room and the player sits basically in another room, listening to something else maybe. If it's a big stage, then we listen to the monitors and the audience listens to it. And I was like, could we possibly do this in a different way? And one of the things was, I would take one of these small battery-driven amps and mount it on my guitar and then walk into the audience just to see what happens if I sort of change the perspective. Or if you all of a sudden hear a theme that you heard maybe the saxophone player beautifully in one end of a song or a composition, and then at some point you all of a sudden hear the same melody by whispered by a really stupid amp somewhere.
Yeah.
Just close this one.
So that's dynamic and spatial experimentation, so to say. And it's you. I think you used the term research, right?
Yes, I used the term investigation.
Investigation. Yeah.
Because this is not an official research project. Which also. But to me, it's very similar. I had people compare it to a PhD, but I don't know if you could. You cannot call it a PhD. It's not an official PhD. But that also gave me some freedom to say I don't have to conclude in that way. I don't have to be academic. I can make a work that sort of.
It's more like an essay somehow.
Well, I call it the poetics of the project because now we're getting to the books. Because what I felt with the music was okay. I'm looking into this. And I started writing down my thoughts on it because I was trying to sort of maybe make myself wiser on myself. So I wrote a lot of stuff and also there's the whole thing that I do a lot of graphics. I've been doing graphics for most of my professional lives for my own albums and for other people's albums also. I've been doing a lot of work for Django Bates and Lotte Anker and Jakob Davidson and a lot of people. And I have the tools to work with graphic art, and for me that was like supernatural to sort of merge this with my investigations, and sort of illustrate both technical setups, or maybe do something that was more like a graphic score, maybe treat a photo in a certain way that made me think of a certain of music, or do a drawing, and move it into the computer and continue working with different graphic tools to sort of make artwork that would represent the music. And all of a sudden you have something that I call the poetics of the project. But poetics not only in writing, but also in scores, in illustrations, in photos from the sessions and from the work. So it's more like sort of, you call it the philosophy of the project or the thoughts behind it or a way of expressing the language that I think I found, or at least trying to share what's been going on in my mind. Some of it is very personal. Some of it almost looks like poetry. And some of it is more like, is more resembles an academic text talking about, okay, and then I did this and did this investigation and I did it in this way. And these experiments mounted into this, and when I was doing this, I was kind of disappointed with this, so I tried something else, blah, blah, blah. Sort of describing the methods, because that methodology is really important. So I'm occupied with my artistic methods, with my artistic praxis. How do I work? How do I work best? Of course, it's like that has a whole variety of parameters, but also, and what comes out of it if I work like this? What comes out of it if I work like this?
I wish we could show this right now on video or something, like give a look into the book, but I think people just have to buy the book or look it up online.
Sure.
You do include, for example, schematics of how your position was when you're playing, which I think is more of the investigative side. Exactly. Yeah. And then you even include some of the scores. In that book, right? In the orange
one? Both of them. There are scores in both of them. Not many, but...
Yeah. So you...
Also some drawings.
As you said before, exactly. Yeah. It dances on the line between being purely art and being like an investigative research or something. Sure. Like it dances in between. And I think that's very interesting. And a big part of this whole project, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's two different books.
Yes.
And accompanying with it, two different albums, I guess. Yeah.
Two different, also, sort of, it's also represented as two different albums online or wherever you get.
Okay, so you don't, I actually didn't check that. You don't buy them in bulk together?
You can buy them in bulk together. Okay. Yeah, sure.
But you can also buy them separately.
You can buy them separately.
Okay, yeah.
But the whole thing, let me explain the two volumes, because the whole thing was that the blue one, the volume one, is solo.
Yeah.
It's just me. It felt like the natural place to start if I the thoughts I was having about guitar playing and the thoughts I was sort of dealing at the time. I feel like, okay, I have to start with myself.
That's also still different setups. Sometimes four speakers, sometimes two, or is it the same?
No, it's different setups, but for mostly different the same habitat, or mostly the same environment.
Yeah. Okay.
And into that environment, then I invited Lars Greve, Simon Toldam, and Francesco Bigoni, but on different times. So there's something with Lars Greve and me duo, there's something with Simon and me duo, and something with Francesco and me duo. And then Simon and Francesco and I did some trio work also, which was nice. But the whole idea was to invite fellow musicians or peers into my environment, the stage that I had set, or the habitat that I sort of hosted. I felt like a host when I was in. So it was more like, okay, if I play like this, if I sound like this, how will you play? If I play out of these two speakers, what will you do? If I play out of these four speakers, what will you do? What will you do if we play this habitat improvised? What will you do if I give you a song and we play this song? This material, the written material is fairly simple and enables us to sort of react to what's going on in the room instead of being super focused on technically hard music. So I allowed myself to introduce some kind of fairly simple, maybe romantic music actually into this project, which was nice.
Did you ask specific questions to the players, or were these like more rhetorical, conceptual questions you asked yourself? Like, how would you react? Did you actually like ask them? Like, okay, so I'm doing this. How did you feel? Or was it more like, you know these players so well that you can kind of understand how they...
I'm truly grateful that these players gave me some of their time to research or to do this project with me. And then they're super sensitive, so a lot of times you can over-talk stuff. But I did introduce them to the technical setup. I sort of explained them, okay, now I'm doing something with these two satellite speakers. You will hear strange sounds, or you will hear something that you're not used to from a guitar player, because now I'm playing through four speakers and that's not so usual. Try and react to that in some way. In some instances, I also tried out the setup without telling people what was going on. I just...
How did that work?
That was actually really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I had a session with Evan Parker and Peter Brun in the same studio. And that exists. I still have that. That's on the desk. And you could sort of... Evan, he started playing, trying to play to it, sort of hitting sort of the same key or the same sort of zone. While the drummer... He was more like into, but listen, now I sound all acoustic. I would like to be sort of also heard through a crappy amp or something like that. So that would be one kind of reaction.
And then with Peter, who did some experiments in that direction.
Yeah, yeah. And another time, there was a saxophone player live who sort of thought, okay, that speaker is kind of saying strange. I think it's a mistake. Then he sort of went and disconnected my speaker, which was super fun. We had a lot of laughs about that. And then, of course, a lot of people felt it like it was an inspiration, or it sort of widened the room, the playing room, or the spatiality of the room we were playing in, which is super nice. And also kind of went into this super soft zone with me where everybody plays sort of the very, very soft nuances of their instruments, but has them blown up.
Mm.
There's a lot of sort of also a lot of trust involved in that. It's super nice.
I mean, that works especially great live with all the spatial experiments. When I listen to the music, I just listen to it on my two speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of the spatial aspect gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think about doing it in 5.1 or something? Or is it just so far away from the audience?
I did, actually. I have released music in 5.1.
Yeah.
The project called Omdreininger that I mentioned before.
Yeah.
Has video with 5.1 music to it. If you buy the LP, you get a stick with video in 5. But nobody has 5.1 at home. That's the problem. I mean, you can. I did it because I found it. I really needed that project to be available in a true surround environment or in a true surround media.
Yeah.
But with this project, it's more. I have. Of course, you can, or I agree with you that it's an interpretation of what's going on. But it always will be. What we did then was spend quite a lot of time sort of finding the sweet spot in between the different speakers, and the third layer that I haven't talked that much about, which is recording the electric guitar acoustically, having a microphone close to the body of the electric guitar, and then recording that, and then blending it in with the other stuff. That some tracks has more of that, some has less, some has only the acoustic guitar sound from an electric guitar, which is kind of a paradox, but still has a lot of. So in that way, we have tried to sort of do this dual or triple layer guitar. We have interpreted it into a stereo format.
Yeah.
And truly, it is a compression, or it is a
it's just different, sort of, I think, right? Like,
I just found it different, but I think and there's some places where I actually sort of almost every time I heard it, and I've heard it a lot of times, I sort of turn my head because I feel that something's going on behind me or something. So you can actually make that work. I have an ambition that a natural thing would be to spend some time with binaural stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be interesting because that works on headphones.
Yeah. But what's that?
Binaural is you have a pair of stereo microphones, but mounted in a head, like a toy head.
Ah, okay, yeah.
That you place and it actually listens the way a human set of ears would listen.
Yeah.
And it has a sort of a three-dimensional effect. There is a spatial effect. A lot of stuff exists on the net, and it works with headphones. It doesn't work on speakers. It works when you have headphones, because then you can sort of actually experience this thing that humans are orienting themselves with their ears a lot. Mm. I mean, we see so much more with our ears than with our eyes, actually. I mean, that's a little way of expression. Of course, human beings see with their eyes, but the idea that we see with our eyes and hear with our ears, that's just something that human beings are saying because that's the easy way to understand it.
But
we locate things with our ears a lot, and what the brain gets through our ears is added to what we see. So there's a whole, it's much more complicated. I mean, you see with your ears.
Otherwise, you would be totally blind to anything that happens.
You also hear with your eyes because you see something and you know what it sounds like, and then your brain will add, "Oh, don't worry, it's just the sound of that because I know what it looks like." Mm. But if you don't see it, then maybe you hear it differently. So it's the way we're using our senses is super interesting, and there are a lot of people working with that. And I think one thing that is nice to sort of to mention here is that this project is not. This is not sort of like a multiple speaker project or ambisonics or Dolby. It's much more lo-fi. I have made it part of my instruments so that I can actually move it into a room with acoustic instruments and use it there. And I don't have to design a whole room to actually be able to do this. I can, you know, put a crappy speaker out in the middle of the audience or a good speaker by, which I also tried, and make these sort of spatial effects or make this multi-layered guitar happen in a very practical way also, which is sort of part of the project.
I'm just wondering how it feels, because for me, like, playing with one amp feels like one thing, and playing with two amp feels, especially if they're two very, very different amps, if you play with one, like, fancy Fender amp and one, like, transistor amp that is cheap, I always feel like the guitar grows, it gets a little bit bigger. So when you do four and you do such different amp, do you feel like it's even, do you feel it's bigger, or how
feel omnipotential by that, like, you're everywhere, you can sort of, you can sit on the whole soundscape
because the room. Not necessarily loud, but like
presence.
You have presence, but and that's also a challenge. I mean, because then you sort of have to be aware of how, at a lot of places I'm using two different effect chains. You really have to be aware of what are you actually sending into the room and how much. So you really have to use your sort of musical sense when you want to give space to the other musicians, or if you really want to sort of come in strong and have impact on something or set a direction, a clear direction, then it's easy to do that.
Mm.
Of course, also with fairly soft playing on the the physical guitar. But of course, it's really being omnipotential or being sort of in power
great responsibility.
With great responsibility comes great.
Well, with great powers comes great
responsibility. Spider-Man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's just a nice creative challenge, I think. But it's kind of
because I often feel especially when playing with piano players, they often they're so massive, not loud, but massive in their sound.
Yes, so, you feel like...
So you always feel very small. You feel like the small brother and you're just I can yell louder than you. But it will just sound like yelling, you know what I
mean? Exactly. Yeah, but that's the whole...
So this sounds like it flips this dynamic maybe on its head?
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel and how does the piano player feel? Because that's really interesting because they're not so used to this. Do they become very, hands-off or how do you feel? I guess
it's different.
Simon is also so experienced that he... And very musical and very... Yes. What you say, reacts fast, I guess. So maybe it's like the perfect guy to test it with. Maybe that's why you chose him.
They will actually be. We are releasing a few videos from the studio. Nice. We have already released one, and we'll be releasing a few more also with Simon. So then you can actually see how he reacts, which is super cool. I spent a lot of time working with electric guitar and piano, acoustic piano, and it's super difficult. You feel like a rhino in a porcelain shop, right?
Yeah.
Because even if you don't use distortion, the electric guitar is distorted. There is distortion, and the piano is such a crystal clear sort of that whole with so many harmonics and overtones.
Yeah.
That the guitar it becomes rude. It becomes a rude instrument, sort of compared to this. Especially if you're using big grand pianos with large or long strings in the bottom and stuff like that. But then if you start changing the spatial perspective, then and maybe using even going lower, so you use crappy amps, then all of a sudden you have a whole other sort of the aesthetics of the whole thing changes, and then all of a sudden they play much better together.
Mm.
And then I have spent really a lot of time playing with my fingers instead of playing with a pick, on my right hand, which also makes me very much in control of dynamics and sound. So I've tried this both with Jakob Anasko and Emanuele Menschelko and with Simon and other players, but mostly with these three actually, that when we can get the whole thing to sound like one big string instrument, when you can actually hear that the piano is a stringed instrument, then stuff starts to happen. Then the blend happens, and that's what, at least that's what I'm always going for. You need the blend because it's such an important part of the music coming together or the voice of the music coming together is when the instruments blend. So, which means they sort of hit the same timbre, you can say, and that's the goal. I'm not sure. I will leave it up to somebody else to see if I succeed in doing that. But sort of when you can hear that there are strings in the piano and there are strings in the guitar and we're just the guitar's plucking maybe and the piano's hammering, but still. And what Simon did, of course, his reaction to this was to go into the piano and use his fingers inside the piano. And all of a sudden we are both plucking strings.
Mm.
And then you sort of have a new blend or new musical universe, which was super beautiful. Or you prepare the guitar, using plastic or different stuff that you put into the string, making it sound maybe even folkloristic in some way. You can do the same with a grand piano if you prepare the grand piano, sort of maybe a John Cage style, that would maybe give the listener some kind of idea. But then you all of a sudden this whole struggle between the electric guitar and the piano. It doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. It's just music there.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But I also feel like it's not like they're not fighting together. I think, or they're not, I think it's a one-way fight more than the other. I feel like the, when I play with a piano, most piano players, I feel like whatever I do, I
you have to fight your way in, or
yeah, because they also, because they have like, they have 10 fingers and they do like, if you, and they like, and then they play all the notes, yeah, and then like,
but that's the whole
which it's my note now, it's
exactly, but I have stopped that fight. I don't do it. I don't want to go there because I don't feel there's any potential in there. It's, there's just struggle.
Yeah,
and exactly. I want to play music. So that's also a big part of this project, or the whole one of the reasons why I think I came up with, or over some months I realized that I had to do this. Was also that I could hear myself say again and over to my students and myself, saying, play guitar music. What is the strong aspects of the guitar?
Don't try to be a different instrument.
And I was raised at least with very sort of a jazz tradition, playing Charlie Parker lines, playing piano chords. Piano, trying to emulate piano voicings, right, on the guitar, which taught me a lot, and it's really an important part of, and I'm grateful for that. It's great, but then when you sort of all of a sudden you hear Derek Bailey, and he's sort of plays instrument idiomatically. He plays the language that the guitar plays well. If you hear, say Mark Ribo, he really sort of introduces the whole, you know, folkloristic thing, and the whole fingers on the string, and you can sort of hear this distortion, and all of a sudden, and the bending, you know, a piano cannot bend.
No.
A guitar, you can bend as a, so all of a sudden microtonal stuff becomes important. Can I actually play something that's microtonal on the guitar? I spend a lot of time doing that also. I do a lot of bending on these records also, where I bend the guitar in different ways. I press strings in weird ways, sort of to get this on purpose out of tune stuff, because the guitar can do it. So playing the idiom of your guitar is really important, I think, because that's, I find that when I look at this, all of the strong players that I've been looking up to, or my idols, it's always really personal, and it's always sort of dealing with the strengths of their own instrument. They to sort of unfold the instrument in your personal way, but also doing what the instrument does well, instead of trying to be something else, which is super. I really like that. It's really important for me in my music to do that.
Yeah, when I studied in my bachelor, one of the teachers I remember said to the full room of students of my year, the best solo you play is the one where if you transcribe it, you can't see which instrument it originated from. Yeah. Like he said, the greatest saxophone solos could be played by a pianist as well. Like the notes, they don't sound like they're just based on the keys or something. And the same for guitar and everything. And I always thought that's such a weird, like that's such a technical way of looking at a specific skill on a certain instrument.
It's very insane if you like John Coltrane.
It's something that was perpetuated to the students that you, especially as a guitarist, right? Like you have to transcribe all the saxophone players, and
exactly.
You have to do piano solos and whatnot, and don't do the guitar thing. And I think like this investigation you did, this books you bring out, can be seen as a testament also to not fall into that trap, right? Because I think it's a big trap that definitely some of my student friends fell into, like. They try to make the guitar not sound like a guitar all the time, and are always unhappy with how the guitar sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like they chose this instrument, and then they always bitch about how the instrument sounds. It's like
exactly, and maybe that is something that all people dealing with instruments will say at one point or the other
course,
in their career. But I really think the other statement that any given sound can be played by any instrument, that then you solely focus on. Sort of the architecture of melody, for instance, or the arrangement of notes, of pitches. And I just find that, you know, when I hear Charlie Hayden play bass, an upright bass. I hear sort of the strings. I hear there's so much more to it than just the notes he played.
The best and Charlie Hayden solo should be played by a tenor saxophone.
Exactly, but that's it's not that I don't think there's something to be learned to play solos from other instruments. I mean, for instance, I've been since my daughter started playing clarinet. I've been fooling around with her clarinet, and just for me, playing an instrument that doesn't play more than one note at a time is super great, and I learned from that. But I mean, it's just it's an important thing to understand that sort of on the guitar, for instance, it's not just about, you know, there are keys that are stronger than other keys because I can use a certain set of open strings. So maybe this song that I spent a lot of time doing these sort of diagrams on specific fingerings, ways of playing things on a guitar that I would not for my life transpose anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's made for a guitar tuned this way.
Yeah.
And then now we're arriving at something. Another thing is that a guitar can be retuned, which is super difficult on a piano, which is also a nice thing to do. So there's so many strengths that you have to, I really feel that that's the place you should go and investigate. Sort of.
I was just wondering, one thing is like the thing about like, bring it back to the thing with the, you chose this instrument and then you bitch about how it sounds. Mm-hmm. I think that's because, especially in institutions, you are taught to learn a specific music that maybe isn't the guitar's music. And when you chose guitar, you probably didn't want to play jazz.
Exactly. But that's...
To be completely honest, like I didn't...
Bam! That,
like, you heard all this strong rock and roll or whatever, all these cool things where the guitar really shines, right? And then you take it out and you put it and you think you're going to sound like something...
I'm still wondering what all these saxophone players and piano players are doing at the RMC. No, but listen, that's fun. They're great musicians. But listen, what I try to do with this was to sort of sort all these thoughts and do categories. So I have I've listed different categories, and try to explain. On these types of tracks, I'm using an effect where I can actually try and have some kind of conversation with myself. It's an effect that sort of will feed my own signal back to me in a weird way. It's kind of, so we are sort of having this conversation with a pedal, which sounds really strange, but the pedal only repeats what I'm giving into it. So, and that's it. You should hear that and I should not go into deep explanation about what's going on. Then there's other tracks that has to do with pitch. I was talking about sort of bending and stretching the guitar and microtonal stuff. Other stuff that has to do with
timbre.
And playing a song also.
Yeah.
There's some stuff that I consider these are songs. These have song quality, should be considered that. It's not always super strict or super logical, but I've just listened to all of these. I mean, I ended up with 148 minutes of music, and there were hours and hours and hours of research material that I kind of listened through, and I found that there were some zones that I kept repeating. The same zone I kept playing or kept trying to sort of solve artistically or musically. Yeah. That I kept going back to, and sort of I've tried to order it so it's possible for somebody else to sort of maybe get more of an idea about what's going on. So these different categories exist. I've made the system so you can maybe find your way through my snorkeled thoughts.
Yeah, because it's not constructed like a 1970s prog rock album where it's like, I guess it is in some way, but it's not meant to be like a volume one is not necessarily meant to be like a full opus or whatever you call it. Is it both?
Sort of the album as a story.
Yeah, yeah.
As a telling from A to Z.
Yeah.
No, it's not. I mean, and I would normally do that. Yeah. I would consider ordering my music or the tracks or the songs or the compositions, whatever you call them, in a way that makes sense sort of on the overall bow. And I did that with this, but there's so much music that at some point I was like, I don't want to cut away more music because I think what's on there should be there because it illustrates different parts of the process. But if I sort of look at the albums as a listener, I would be like, maybe there's too much music here. So that's why I would really like people to sort of look into the work, find stuff they like, and order them on their own playlist. Maybe leave something out. I mean, I consider this sort of like a collection of butterflies or a thesaurus, like a dictionary of my language or my investigations here. Mm. So I would really encourage people to sort of maybe make their own tungemål playlists and find what they like about these things.
I guess you can also mix volumes.
You can mix volumes, and you can also only take tracks from one category. Only listen to the stuff that has to do with pitches. Maybe that's also a nice listening experience.
You have tried that in your...
I tried all different ways of listening to the stuff.
But did you... I mean, because with Spotify and these providers nowadays, you can totally put playlists there yourself. Did you plan on putting a specific like multiple different playlists? Say, this is a way of listening to this album. Or to the music. This is a different way of listening to this music.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing to do. I encourage people to do that themselves, and then send it to me.
Okay.
Mm. I would like people to send me their playlists. That's much more interesting than me doing a playlist number 275 that I already have.
Yeah, or you do like, this is Francesco's playlist or something, or this is Simo's playlist.
In some way, in volume 2, I have sort of kept it, sort of there is some kind of chronological order in it. It starts with a lot of Lars Greve, and then some more Simon, and then some more Francesco, with a few overlaps and stuff. But that is also the way they entered the studio, in the order.
You also write a little bit of about you call it unpredictability or your relationship to that. And I was just thinking about that, because that's a word that's get thrown around like a lot in our field or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interesting thought about it. And I always had a strange connection to that word, because I always think about it more as confusion or misunderstanding, because I don't know how much... unpredictability for me, I don't know how do you harness energy from that, but you can totally harness energy from confusion.
Sure.
But maybe it's like a semantics, I don't know. Maybe
words can always, you know, they tend to be loaded with the energy or with the sort of meaning that maybe you don't want them to. But when you're saying that, I'm thinking, are you talking about sort of imperfection or imperfection?
Maybe that's...
Are you talking about randomness? Because that's two different things, maybe.
Yeah.
Are you thinking more of the aleatoric kind of...
Meaning?
Alia is Latin for dice. So, like, randomness,
I guess. No, I'm more talking about sort of flaws, mistakes.
Yeah.
Stuff that will happen that...
Or maybe I misunderstood what I read.
Yeah, maybe that... And I find that there are a lot of gifts, musical gifts,
in imperfection.
In the imperfection, in the flaws. I don't want to straighten out my music totally. Or I find that I have studied with people, and I have listened to music that is so polished that it doesn't affect me in the same way. I can kind of, maybe it can be my personal sort of taste. Some people really need the ordering. They feel that if there is this kind of, you know, a clarinet that all of a sudden squeaks, or a singer that all of a sudden has a trembling voice because she's moved by something or whatever. But in my view, I find that these faults holds the notion that there's a person behind, and that the person is readily and or willingly sort of... pushing the music, and therefore ready to take to take the fall when something happens that it maybe didn't intend to happen.
It's outside of their complete comfort control.
Because you can stay within your comfort zone, but that also means that maybe there's not that much at stake, because you stay when you're totally definitely sure that you will play everything super right every time. And I'm much more interested in the stuff that lies in between. I mean, I have a trio with Francesco Bigoni and Emanuele Maniscalco. We will work deliberately with concepts. It will say in our written music, we play a lot of composed stuff, avoid aligning, for instance. So you have a score, you can see that all of these sort of three voices should sort of officially a MIDI program would play them all at one, and we deliberately say, hey, we are actually interested in that the one is like sort of something in between, maybe starts a little before and comes a little after, because I find that there's beauty there. There's the notion of the human being as a performer and as an artist, and if I wanted a MIDI file, I would program a computer, which is also and that's a whole other concept I can totally deal with. That there are definitely a lot of beautiful art that has that involves computer and perfect, super timed MIDI like playing or MIDI like or computers doing something that maybe is in contrast to what we do as human beings. But in general, I try to sort of what I'm writing in the book is that a good friend of mine is always considers sort of the mistake or the you know, just when something, you can just say there's a little, she considers that a room of opportunity.
Yeah.
Much more than something that you should bang your head against.
I used to go to some psychology lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one lecture specifically where the professor spoke about that there, like he drew a circle on the board and said, like, this is your comfort zone. And then this is chaos, like around. And he said, whenever you do something, and especially if you want to do something creative, you should always aim to go just beyond your comfort zone. Not totally into really far away chaos, because then you have no control and you have no whatever, right? But he spoke about this sweet spot that's like, I mean, on the board, it was like the 5 centimeters around. I remember it visually.
But I understand. I totally understand. Yeah. But it's definitely...
That sounds to be like the exact same thing you speak about. Yeah.
It's definitely also... It is a sweet spot. I find that it is a sweet spot. You can fuck everything up and be totally destructive in your way of playing, which is also an aesthetic expression, I guess. But so I find that the notion or the idea of sort of letting some of this in and still keeping it sort of on track, that there's a will, there's a direction, there's an artistic vision, that there is a song here that we're trying to play. I mean, the classic example is Miles Davis. I mean, he's a master of fucking up and making it into beautiful music. I mean, you hear it on so many of his records.
And sometimes the other people around him make it to make it into beautiful music, not only him.
That's part of it, for sure. But, hey, but playing music is something you do together. It's not something you do alone.
I recently checked out Bitches Brew. Again, it's a great album, right? It's really cool. But sometimes he plays some really bad stuff. and it's not just like a whole track or something. It's just like, if I played this line, I wouldn't be happy. But I mean, as when you listen to it as a whole piece of art, it's awesome, legendary. But if you nerd on specific things and like as you would do with your own stuff, you probably wouldn't be like, this is great.
I'm definitely not talking about not doing the work or being lazy.
Yeah.
But I'm more talking about redo or correct sort of or rectify your mistakes, especially today with all the technology that we have going on. But do you really want to?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you really want to rectify Miles Davis's fuck ups on Bitches Brew? Not in my life.
No.
That's part of the stuff. But do I sort of would I ever sort of consider not preparing for a concert or for a studio recording because I thought that, hey, I'm going to play a lot of mistakes anyway. So why prepare? I would not. Some people would, I know, but I would not.
I think Miles sometimes wouldn't prepare. I think he said that he was too lazy to be a trumpet player.
Trumpet players.
But he did have moments in his career.
Oh, sure. Now it sounds like I'm bashing him, but I mean, I think he's awesome, but I think it's just so funny when you have that you have this inspiration through your life and you have it like on a pedestal for years, and then suddenly you don't listen to it or you have some distance to it, and then you maybe become more musical yourself, or you have more experience, and then you suddenly hear very different things from the same thing you heard, and it's just so interesting that you.
But if
yeah,
but if you consider that sort of the maybe let's say that there is a mistake parameter, or there's a fault parameter. Can you actually, as a musician, sort of open that door more or less? Considering in relation to what kind of music you're playing, is there some music that needs a little more opening of the fuck up door?
Yeah.
Or is there, and definitely there's some music that needs less of that.
Yeah.
Because if you want to play super precise music, and some music needs to be super precise, then maybe you need to almost close that door. But it's I would consider just leaving it open slightly, right?
It also depends on the instrument and in what way you fuck up. Like if you play a big stage rock concert and you're the drummer and you fuck up in the timing, I mean, that's not excusable, right? But
it's hard to sort of interpret or experience as a musical thing, and the minute if you would experience that a musical thing, then maybe it would be okay.
That's
probably
but if you're sitting
in
front of a big band or behind a big band being the drummer, and then and everybody else trips on the floor because you do, then maybe it's
it's really hard to see that musical as musical.
Then maybe it comes down to what is whether things are intentional or not intentional. But the whole thing about flaws and faults is that you cannot deliberately make a fault. Maybe you can sort of trick your mindset into being receptive to these things or being open to these things happening, but you cannot sort of say I will make a fault on 3 and right.
But for me, this whole question also boils down to how your own reaction to your own faults is, right?
Exactly.
Like, because when I review, like, one of the first albums I recorded with my own music, I ended up not releasing because I was too concerned about the mistakes.
Oh shit!
Yeah, and nowadays I think I totally should have released that, right? But I mean, back then it's also long ago, and I was younger and blah blah blah. But I was so concerned with the mistakes I made that I ended up saying no to putting it out there.
Exactly. Yeah, but you probably didn't see all the things that were correct, right?
Mm. But hey, listen,
whatever.
At least I was too concerned about the mistakes. And it's like, it took me some time to grow as a human being and as a musician before I'm now able to actually see, like, no, this was a legit art of music, a piece of music or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, I should have put it out there, but yeah.
Exactly, but the whole thing is, I mean, we have to deal with that ourselves in some way. It is a personal thing, and everybody, every human being in the universe has a sort of an urge to look good, to be sexy, to be on top of things, to look good in other people's eyes, because we mirror each other in the other persons, in the other, so that's a natural thing to do. I think it's part of evolution, or part of, somebody can say something much more wise than I can about that, but I feel sort of, and the whole thing I think about playing music is that, does the music really need me to look good now, or to play all of my technical abilities here now, or does it need me to do something else? What does the music need? Or in opposite, or sort of, not what do I need?
Mm.
And and of course the younger you are, the more you're concerned with what do I need. It's a natural thing, but it's also sort of just, I really like it when I hear musicians and artists performing and playing and recording, and you can sort of hear what they do is because the music craves a certain thing, needs this input, and not it's not about demonstrating technical abilities or rectifying faults or playing the perfect. Something it's not about not preparing, it's not about not practicing, it's not about being lazy, it's not about not investing 210% within the music, it is exactly about investing everything for the music or for what the music needs, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, like that thing of what does the collective need or whatever, what does the other need, that's something I think Lotte Anker is one of the ones that impresses me the most. She plays a saxophone, which is very, like, very often on top, but she's such a team player, especially when I've never played with her, so I don't know, but when I see her play with others, I just, like, wow, she's like, she plays this very individualistic instrument, at least in the jazz tradition. It's very like, it's on top, it's like, ah, oh, but she's like, she, yeah, she's so good at that. It's so impressive, I think.
Yeah. But the whole, you can say, I have released a lot of albums and I've written a lot of music and recorded it. And I found that at some point I found that I was really not very concerned with making guitar albums. If you look at what I've been recorded, they're not guitar features. They're not sort of, for instance, there's the one called Solborg 4+4+1 with Chris Pete and a lot of beautiful players, and I wrote this large ensemble music. And I think maybe there's one guitar solo there, because I really haven't been concerned with that, sort of staging myself as an instrumental soloist. But the reason for Tungemål is actually that I found that I needed to sort of do some research on my own instrument and on my voice as an individual soloist to be able to do what Lotte Anker does, or to be a better team player. I found that at some point I needed more of that, or needed to do some serious sort of in-depth research on that myself solely, and especially do a solo album. What do you do when you play solo? It's really important, and it has given me so many more, so much more, what do you,
tools?
Tools for executing and executing the music as I hear it, which is and has also, of course, given me sounds and tools that I didn't knew was in my playing, and that way I found that it has been a very sort of satisfactory and very giving process to do these two books, and to sort of try and sort of narrow the scope down to sort of some very basic and important things in the way you play guitar, and at least the way I play the guitar.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's I think that's a beautiful way to end, also, because we have been talking for an hour now. I think maybe you want to plug yourself, or you want to say about the where people can buy the books.
Oh yeah, I could do that. The books and the music is available. Or let me put this in another way. You can get to the books by going to the ilpmusic.com website. There's a web shop where you can buy them. You can also buy them in selected bookstores in Copenhagen. You can order them in different record shops. You can also order them on Bandcamp. There's quite a lot of places you can get to this. The music itself is available on any streaming platform, but I highly recommend that you have the books while listening to the music. It's so much more fun. So order the books and have them emailed, or have them mailed to you.
Great. That's it. Yeah. Are you performing with this specific project in the nearer future? I mean, that's, everything is in the air, of course, with Corona.
Actually, Simon Toldam, Francesco, and I just performed in Svendborg by coincidence. Simon was
in Giant Steps.
Yeah, he was a substitute.
Yeah.
But we will be performing during winter jazz. Lars Greve and Simon Toldam, and there will be more during the spring. But now everything is a little insecure with the whole Corona situation.
Yeah. But people can find out about that on your website.
On my website, yes.
Which is
www.solborg.dk.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and speaking
really
with us.
Yeah.
It's great.
Interesting.
And bye bye to the listener. Bye bye.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.